Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Season 4, Episode 10 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to our last episode for season number 4, where we're talking about the 1990 Mr. Olympia. And today we have our second part of our interview with Peter McGuff. We aired the first part about 2 weeks ago. And then last week, of course, we had our special episode with Dan Solomon, who joined us to talk about the movie Bigger and also about the unfortunate passing of Sean Perrine. So thanks to Dan for joining us at last minute notice like that. But we wanted to get that insight about the movie Bigger since Dan just finished wrapping that up. All right. And as I said, today we are going to be talking with Peter McGuff, and this will be our second part of our interview because we talked for so long. And we had so much to talk to Peter about, not just the 1990 Mr. Olympia, but also the state of bodybuilding today. And that's what we're going to talk about in this interview. We talk a little bit more about the 1990 Olympia, but really our focus of our interview on this part of the interview was more about what's happening with bodybuilding today, how it's changed, how we've gone away from the magazines, which is what Peter and I grew up with. And we've changed now also to just internet-based reporting, and we don't get the same coverage that we used to. So it's good points and bad points, and that's what we're going to talk about with Peter today. As I mentioned, we are brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One. And at Redcon One, everyone wants to be a champion, everyone wants to be the best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. So whether you're killing it in the gym or you're trying to run a 6 minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you the extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And you can fuel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And enter the discount code LEGENDS and you'll get a 15% discount off your order. We're also brought to you by Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs now for several years. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They are the brand that I used to win the Masters Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. And they're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the new 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and also Sergio Oliva Jr. And they just brought on Samir Benoot last week. So they are really adding to their stable. And I believe also the latest news is that Breon Ansley is going into the Arnold Classic, and he'll be competing in the Classic Physique there. So that's going to be really exciting as he's going to defend his Mr. Olympia title. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go on to oldschoollabs.com, and you'll get 12% off of any order. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, I just got back from celebrating Christmas with my family out in Chicago, so that was a lot of fun. Got to see some old friends, my friends Nick and Al and Dennis, and got to spend a lot of time with my family. We had my niece Chloe's birthday on Saturday. That was her 10th birthday, so that was cool. And then my brother Don had the family party with all our family, our cousins and uncles and aunts and my mom and dad, and everybody was there, so that was a good time. That was Sunday on Christmas Eve. We had that at his house. So it started to get a little cold by the time I got out of there. I think it was like 1 degree by the time I left last night. So that's why our show is a little bit late this week. We're a couple of days late. Instead of on Monday, we're going to have it today on Wednesday. Hope everybody had a great Christmas, and looking forward to a brand new year, 2018. And we are working right now on season number 5 for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and that will be about the NABBA Mr. Universe. So that's going to be pretty different. There's a lot of great athletes that went through the NABBA Universe. I think it started in 1950 with Steve Reeves winning it, and over the years, many of the legends of the sport, Reg Park, Bill Pearl, Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, Frank Zane, Chris Dickerson, Boyer Coe, Serge Nubre, all the greats have gone and competed in the NABBA Mr. Universe contest. Many of them have won that contest. So there's a lot of history there, and that's what this show is all about. So we're going to start off our interview, should be next week, and our first interview will be with Wayne Galash. And Wayne was one of the legends in the sport, as far as I'm concerned, because Wayne was there. In fact, he was at every NABBA Mr. Universe from 1970, when Arnold won his last Mr. Universe, his fifth one. And he was there starting at 1970, going all the way to 2008. He saw every NABBA Mr. Universe. So we're going to do a long interview with Wayne Galash to kick off the season. And he's the perfect guy to talk to. I'm also going to be trying to talk to some of the guys who have won that contest over the years. So I'm working on getting some of those interviews set up. So it should be a really, really great season. And thank you to all of our listeners out there for listening to the show. If you guys could leave a little comment on iTunes telling you how much you like the show, I think that will help the ratings and get the word out there to more people to listen to the show every week. So our listenership is growing, and I appreciate the support of everybody out there, because I know a lot of people like myself, you guys really like to hear about the old stories of bodybuilding, which I consider the magical era of the sport. All right, and my books are also selling really well, so thanks to all of you out there who have purchased the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1 and also the MP6 Workout. They are both available on Amazon.com, and as I mentioned before, I have some copies available. If you want to purchase an autographed copy from me, you can just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll get you one of those. They're doing really, really well. We just got them out in November. So the response has been really good. So I'm really happy about that. And also, speaking of reviews, if you purchase the book off of Amazon, you can leave a book review on Amazon. So if you guys could do that, I would really, really appreciate it. All right. I also want to mention we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. They also offer very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. Those are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. So they are located in Tampa, Florida, and you can give them a call at 813-922-8939, but they will work with anybody throughout the United States. Again, that number is 813-922-8939. If you want to email them, you can email them at info@flalternativemeds.com. That's info@flalternativemeds.com. And that is it for the show. Here is the second part of our interview with the legendary Peter McGough, where we're going to talk about the sport of bodybuilding today. Here you go. So now the question I have, and I've asked everybody that I've interviewed about this topic, if they would have kept going with the drug testing, and I know things were changed because of the WBF, but if the IFBB said, no, we're committed to this, we're going to keep going with it, how do you think that would have changed the sport of bodybuilding? Because after that, you know, after 1990, that's really when the mass monsters started coming in, and the sport really did change. Because if you look at the bodybuilders from the 70s and even the 80s, we had great bodybuilders in the 80s, but they looked more human, I guess you could say, and they had more of the symmetry aspect. And, you know, you had guys like McAway winning and Samir Banute winning, Frank Zane, of course, in the 70s winning. And then after that, after 1990, everything changed, and the guys just started getting so big that guys like smaller guys like that would never have a chance of winning again. So the whole sport really did take a turn. So if they would have continued with the drug testing, I mean, what changes do you think it would have made?
I've always felt ambivalent about the whole situation of drug testing. You know, unfortunately for those bodybuilders who were competing in 1990. Mm-hmm. They competed their whole careers without having to worry about a drug test. I also have a background in track and field. And all the current champions, I mean, they've been drug testing for 40 years. You know, the champions of today in the 20s have come through from the beginning knowing they have to pass drug tests. We would have maybe bred a new breed of bodybuilder coming in, youngsters in 1990, you know, amateurs competing in regional shows who then would get to the national level. And from the outset of the career, mainly they'd have to deal with drug testing. And let's be honest, you know, world records continue to be broken. Lance Armstrong won 7 Tour de France's, never failed a drug test. But I have to come back and say, you know, Lance Armstrong won those contests. His dedication won those races. The drugs didn't make him, it wasn't the drugs that pedaled around those, those mountains. You know, it's just another element, and everybody's doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I went on British television at one time, 20-odd years ago, saying that drug testing should be banned, and they talk about bringing drug testing to level the playing field. Well, it does the opposite. You look at the East Germans in 70s and 80s, it was like a conveyor belt, a factory of producing world-class athletes in track and field. They had doctors, physicists, tests. There was even talk about women being made pregnant because apparently when a woman's been pregnant, she comes back stronger and more resilient and blah, blah, blah. Right. Whereas even in America, you know, track and field athletes had to do this on their own, maybe through a college guy or something. So it's never been a level playing field. The only way to level it is to get rid of steroid testing. Mm-hmm. They're going to get by it anyway. You know, they're always one step ahead. So yeah. I'm not sure I've really answered your question, but I think they couldn't take, say, 3 or 4 years of substandard bodies coming through before the new breed came through who'd, you know, started off having to come through drug tests. Mm-hmm. Of course, the way it's gone now, I mean, it's anything goes. And, you know, there's an argument about, well, you know, it's not the sport that we joined. But, you know, it's the human instinct to do, you know, most athletes at the world-class level, you know, sprinters, bodybuilders, whatever, they're almost clinically insane. You know, at the 1976 Montreal Olympics, the athletes were asked in track and field, if we could guarantee you a gold medal, but you'd be dead in 5 years, what would you take? And the majority of them took the gold medal. That's how badly they want it. So they'll do everything. Right. And, you know, I've had to face many journalists, you know, from the mainstream press to blast bodybuilding. I said, okay, you work as a reporter for, say, the Sunday Times. What if somebody came along to you and said, I got this substance that'll improve your writing, your productivity, you'll end up as the editor of the Sunday Times. Wouldn't you be tempted? And of course they said no, but I think we know the answer.
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, they just didn't have the technology for really doing the drug testing correctly. And if you look at other sports, like you said, it's, you know, everybody's just beating the test basically. So I think what happened with bodybuilding where we lost that classic physique look was these other drugs came into the picture, like growth hormone and insulin and synthol and all the other stuff that a lot of these guys are doing now. Yeah. And then the judges just, I guess went along with that. Right. And we started rewarding the bigger look. And we've kind of lost sight of the symmetry and maybe the beauty of bodybuilding that it was in the 70s and 80s.
Right. Yeah. I still think, you know, today it seems to me that size and condition rules, condition mainly, you know, which in many ways is body depleting, not bodybuilding. You know, we have some funny shapes coming out, but if they're cut, then that's fine. I think they could have still kept to the ideal. And of course, Dorian Yates is blamed for all of this, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have to remember, you know, Dorian's first Olympia, 91, he was 257, which was pretty big in those days. And of course, that was 93 when he just rewrote the book walked out, you know. And everybody started to slam on size, but by his last Olympia, I mean, he was 260. He never put on a load of weight after 93.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, his midsection became a problem in later years, but I always think it wasn't him that, it was the people that emulated him that tried to jump on his bandwagon, put it down, all to drugs and everything. And the number of times I've seen Dorian being asked about what secret drug he's got, and I think Muscle Media 2000 said he was hooked up all night to an IV machine pumping stuff into him or something, which was all hooey.
Right.
What they forget is the dedication that he put in to maximize on whatever he was doing. You know, so I think he gets an unfair... Of course, people say I'm biased, his friend, but that's my honest opinion.
You mm-hmm. know,
that he gets... it's a bit unfair to label it all on him. Maybe he was the catalyst, but he didn't say to everybody, get as big as you can. You know, and to me, it's the preparation has gone off the charts.
Yeah.
I used to go on the post-Olympia tours of the 80s and 90s. You go away for 2 or 3 weeks around Europe with, say, 10 or 12 leading athletes, bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You bonded with them. You stayed in the same hotel. You hung out in the backstage. You got on the plane with them. You know, that's where I made a lot of my contacts and lifelong friends. And you'd be sitting in the dressing room with 3 or 4 of them. They start talking about training. You know, I've tried every second day. I've tried that. I've tried this for... They hardly ever talked about drugs.
Right.
Now,
right.
Today... I'm often in a, say, at the Arnold or the Olympia, you're in the restaurant, there's a couple of guys to your side, and they're usually amateurs, not the guys in the contest, and you don't know them, but you can obviously see that they are bodybuilders, and they're only talking about drugs and supplementation and what to do the last week.
Mm-hmm.
You have to build that physique first before you start tampering with it, and I think there's too much of it going on. There are some great contest prep guys, but a lot of guys, especially at the amateur level, you know, they fall into this, I've got to have a guru for a contest, I've got to have a nutrition guru.
Mm-hmm.
God help us, we've even got posing gurus for men's physique.
Right.
You know, it's like, what the hell? You know, what's next? You know, how to hold your water bottle when you're walking around the hotel, you know? It's just taken to that limit. And the amateurs or the guys too much rely on the contest prep guy. Well, it's not right now, 2 days out, but we'll do something tomorrow. Now, you and I have both seen, I'm sure, guys 2 or 3 days out or photos of them, and they look fantastic. They look great.
Mm-hmm.
They show up on stage, and they're not as good. And what's happened, they... get to Thursday, Friday, whatever it is, and somebody tells, well, you're about 95%, let's go for 100. They do something, and then instead of being 95, they're 80%. If we can use them, I don't believe in, you know, the percentages, but I'm using that as an analogy. You know, they're not as good as they were 2 days before because too much messing about.
Right.
You know, Dorian was ready 2 weeks out. All the body fat had gone, and all he did from then on in was to manipulate water and sodium. You know, he was ready, you know, 2 weeks out. There was none of this, you know, I have to lose so much weight the last week. I mean, Flex Wheeler was notorious for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dropping
mm-hmm.
7 or 10 pounds in a week, you know, going cardio crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, when I interviewed Dorian, he mentioned that. He said that, you know, back when he was Mr. Olympia, the talk was always about, as you said, it was the training, you know, and his training was obviously very important to him. You know, he was very analytical about his training. He was constantly making adjustments to it, you know, to make sure that his physique was better than ever. And he put a lot into his training, and he came up with that low volume training style. And he said that's what really changed his physique for the better when he switched over to that. And he said, you know, he goes, if you look at today's bodybuilders, you don't hear any talk about that. They don't talk about the different training methods they're doing or the different eating or nutrition methods they're doing. It's just mostly the talk is about drugs, like you said.
Yeah, and you see, you know, on Facebook, you know, you get guys you never heard of, you know, showing photographs of themselves and saying, I'm trying all these drugs or whatever, and I'll mention the Mr. Poughkeepsie Championship or something.
Right.
And you're thinking, why? Why?
Right.
Developing I know it's hard. Because, you know, they're under pressure from people in the gym. The other thing I've heard so many times, I know exactly what Dorian took, and I'm using it on my guys.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. You know, they've never met Dorian, talked to him or anything, you know. And, you know, it's like Haney, even he had that thing. Well, there must be something secret he's taking. There must be something secret Dorian's taking. Well, if they had a secret, wouldn't they market it after they retired and cash
in?
Right. There's no secret.
Right.
No, everybody was using the same stuff. It came down to what you were doing in the gym and that preparation were, you know, those guys of the 90s got into shape. You know, Levroni, Flex when he was
mm-hmm.
on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dillard in his early years. Sean Ray, obviously.
Yeah.
Dorian, who am I missing? You know, Porter Cottrell, Charlie Clermont, all these guys. Sonny Schmidt. Lee Labrada, sorry about that, Lee. They all, you know, and you ask them, what's different today? How did you get into that shape? And the guys today don't seem to be able to do it. And I think Kevin Levroni summed it up best. He says, because we suffered. You have to
mm-hmm.
suffer to
yeah,
get into
yeah.
that. You have to make do with eating 5 pounds of fish for a month or whatever it is they did. You have to suffer. There's no secret ingredient.
Right. And then the same thing with the training. Like when I talked to Dorian, he said, you know, he goes around the gym now, and he said that he probably made a mistake in retrospect, you know, when he was training for these shows, because he was still training so heavy, and that's how he ended up injuring himself a lot, because his body was depleted. And he said he should have just did more maintenance workouts, because his muscle wasn't going to go anywhere in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And he said when he goes around the gym now and he looks around, he says, that's all I see now is people just maintaining. It's like nobody's really pushing themselves, you know, they're just training easy, you know.
Well, I told him after 94 when he ripped his bicep, I said, look, I wrote in 93 that he would never be beaten. The only thing that would beat him would be an injury. And I actually told the same thing to Joe Weider in 94. Flex Wheeler had his car accident, but a lot of people in the Weider building were saying, 95, Flex will be back. He's the next Mr. Olympia. Dorian's done, you know. And Metrex made an offer to Dorian of $200,000 a year, which was phenomenal in those days. I went to Joe and said, I wasn't the editor then, I was just a senior writer. I said, there's no way Flex will beat Dorian. Dorian is going to hold on to this till he retires. The only thing can beat him is injury. So then Joe signed him. And I even talked to Dorian and said, don't you think you can just tap it down a little bit? You've built the physique. Like you say, you just need to maintain. But he always said, look, I'm a kind of guy. It has to be 100% or no percent. I can't do anything in between.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go into the gym and say, I'm not going to give everything for each workout, each rep. And, of course, when he did his tricep in 97, he could hardly do anything and press or anything. I went to see him. It was in Long Beach, the contest. He arrived a week before I went down to see him.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't dress himself. He couldn't put his trousers up.
Yeah.
He's just done legwork for the previous 7 weeks. And yet still, the muscle did not go away. You know?
Right.
Elsewhere. And he was going to go for 98, but the tricep just didn't heal the way it should. He couldn't handle the weights, and he wasn't prepared to handle lighter weights, and that's why he retired. But also, he did say, you know, that by the time 97 came along, he worried about himself a little bit because he said it was becoming a bit like a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fire to be the best in the world, to be Mr. Olympia, was still there, but it was like, am I doing this because I've got a good income, or am I as, you know, ambitious as I was? And another story about him, the WBF made an approach to Dorian. They flew him to Connecticut, where the headquarters were, after the Night of the Champions. He didn't meet McMahon, he met Linda McMahon. They made him an offer, funnily enough, of $200,000 a year for like 3 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't under contract for it or anybody. He lived in a flat, as we call it in England, like a tenement building, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned that money down because he wanted to be Mr. Olympia.
Wow, that's amazing.
That was the dedication.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a little bit about this classic physique, Peter, because I know I've read a lot of your articles and you feel the same way as I do about the ripped glutes and the emphasis from the judges on ripped glutes over everything else. And I've even complained about some local shows that I've seen where you'll get a guy who has the bloated stomach and he's missing his calves and he doesn't have any biceps and he's got the ripped glutes, and he beats a guy who's got a great physique, you know, who's got everything in proportion. He's got nice symmetry, small waist. And it just seems like a lot of the judges, maybe even some of the newer judges who are brought up in this era, and they don't look at the bodybuilders from the past like we have, and they just overlook the symmetry and the shape, and they're just judging that one aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to name a name, but I've seen a classic physique winner who was highly talented, who won a show with bitch tits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're right, you know, I think the best classic physique at the last Olympia was Chris Bumstead from Canada.
Yeah, the second place guy.
You know, and it's supposed to be, you know, that look, that shape, that tie-in. But I think one of the problems is, and you can go back, you know, we had women's bodybuilding. Then that sort of got too muscular. So let's the fitness girls who, you know, were more into athletics and everything. But they started to get more muscular to, you know, win that physique round. You know, so hang on a minute. Let's be in the figure class. That's how women should look. They got muscular with big whacking shoulders and all sorts of things.
Right.
Bikini class. Let's be in the bikini class. Now, when I see a bikini, I look at, even they are judged on how many ribs can we see? You know, the delts, are they there? And it's like, my God, these should just be really good-looking women who look athletic and honed. I've heard bikini girls, you know, in the foyer saying, yeah, I'm really pleased with the way I look, and I haven't taken a diuretic yet. And I just, where have we gone now? And they're on other stuff as well.
Yeah,
and that's
what
I think happens. My point is, it's very difficult for a bodybuilding judge to suddenly throw criteria out for, say, the men's open and latch on straight away to the classic. But, you know, I really think the classic physique should never have, division should never have been created. It should have always been the classic physique.
Yeah, that's what I was asking about the 1990s. Where did we lose it? You know, where do we stop judging guys for symmetry and shape and beautiful physiques, and then we just went just for the size and the conditioning as far as like the ripped glutes and stuff, and we lost that physical ideal that we used to have, you know.
And at the same time, you know, this is why the men's physique division is so popular.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys, they know they couldn't do it, but they'd love to look like Arnold or Frank Zane,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't think many of them would want to look like some of the guys today. They'll still freak out at seeing somebody like Big Ramy, who's the eighth wonder of the world, but they don't want to be 300 pounds, you know. So, and there's also in the magazine side, which attaches itself to what we're talking about before, how the older guys used to talk about training. A lot of readers look at a mass monster and say, I can't learn anything from him because he's on a barrel load of drugs.
Yeah.
He's got a contract. He can, you know, eat 10,000 calories a day and afford it. He can sleep in the afternoon.
Right,
so
right.
That's unattainable. I can't do it, you know. And they have no faith in what they're being told, you know, because mm-hmm. other voices are telling them, it's all about drugs. It's all about drugs.
Right. And you think about when we were younger and read the magazines, we took it as gospel, every word they said about their training, you know. But Larry Scott did Scott curls, and everybody was doing Scott curls, you know. So we really believed in the training advice back then.
It's funny you should say that about Larry Scott curls. I remember reading one article, and me and my training partner said, right, let's do that routine now. And it was all the Scott curls stuff that he used to do, you know. And it, funnily enough, you could look at a routine, and with no names, that's Danny Padilla does that. You know, that's Arnold's, that's Zane's. Today, we don't have the same connection with what they actually do in the gym.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, I can't name anything that any of the current guys do. You know, I would never know that. Well, the magazines are gone too, though.
Yeah. It's a different world.
Yeah, that's why I was bringing up that classic physique. I didn't mean to get off track there, but I was just saying, you know, maybe that's, we'll give a resurgence of what, you know, the bodybuilders used to look like, and maybe we'll get some more younger kids attracted to the sport if they want to look like those guys, you know?
Yeah, and I think we'll see a transition from some men's physique guys into that classic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought Chris Bumstead won, but he earned his pro card in the Open. But then
yeah,
dedicated
North America, right?
To the classic, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, before we go, I wanted to mention that, you know you had a long association with Joe Weider, and you told me many stories when we talked about, you know, how great he was and stuff. And they are making this movie called Bigger. And I know Dan Solomon's the co-producer, and he invited you out to Birmingham, Alabama. But I got a chance to see that. So that looks like it's going to be a pretty cool movie. So I'm excited about that for next year.
Yeah, I think it's great that Joe's story and Ben's, because he's Elemental, obviously, and he's featured in the film, is told to the mainstream. There's a lot of people training in LA Fitness, strip mall gyms, hotel gyms, who don't realize that they're probably there because of what Joe Weider started.
Yeah.
You know, 50, 60 years ago. It's all spilled out from him and his belief, like he wrote in the 50s, that I predict, you know, that everybody will use weights. All athletes will use weights. I mean, one of the reasons, I had a friend who was a powerlifter when I was 20. For a couple of years, he'd say, come to the gym. I played football and did track and field. I said, no, I'll get muscle bound, you know, stupid.
Right.
Thought then. But as soon as I got in the gym, you know, I got more stamina. I was stronger. I was, you know, nobody could knock me off the ball at football. You know, I got faster. So, you know, that's permeated through. He talked about old people using it to keep the juices flowing and the mobility. Mm-hmm. He was dead right about it. And I hope the film reaches as wide an audience as possible. And, you know, working with Joe, and I did work with Joe, the thing about Joe was, even when I was there as a writer, you know, I had an editor above me, an editorial director above him, a CEO above him, and then was Joe. So there was like three or four levels of management between me and Joe. But Joe was more accessible than all of them. He would come down and go into people's cubicles, office, ask what you're working on. You know, design, why don't you try it out and blow, it'll work better and blow. Now, the thing with Joe is, if you quote him, you drop into the voice. I'm not deliberately doing it. It just wouldn't sound right unless you tried the voice. And everybody has the Joe voice, their own Joe voice. They're all different, but they're all correct.
Right.
Brilliant, in my opinion, is Samir. Samir can do what I've never heard anybody else do. He can do a conversation between Joe and Ben. Next time you see him, ask him to do it. It's absolutely hysterical. But Joe, I don't know how to say it. I suppose I'm at an age now where I can just be totally open.
Mm-hmm.
even as a senior writer, I was somewhat resented at Weider because Joe liked me. And the reason he liked me was because I could talk to him. He'd call me up and he'd talk about old-time guys, and I knew who he was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, what a South African guy. Roy Hilligan, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the one, you know. And I was always, I mean, at the Arnold, I had dinner with Betty Weider. Here he is on a name-dropping tour of Fawcett. She said the reason Joe liked you is because you were always truthful with him. You know, even if it meant falling out. You know, when you fell out with Joe, you wreaked a hurricane, you know. When I took over, my first cover went through okay. My second cover was Lee Priest. Joe didn't like the shot. We went through... See, Lee Priest causes trouble. Even when he's not really involved, he's always the trouble. Right. We went through into the photo library, got all the Lee... Brush it up, our shot, we don't touch one. I said, no, he's got his forearm 2 foot. He goes, don't tell me about picking photographs. I've been picking photographs for 50 fucking years. You know, and I thought, well, he's got a point. But in the end, we used mine, because he always said to me, he disagreed on covers from time to time. And that was the only thing I had to show him was a cover. He wasn't going through the magazine. You know, he'd go through it afterwards and comment, but he wouldn't pre-plant anything. He'd say, I don't agree with that cover, but you're the editor-in-chief, get on with it. So this data that I heard about was not in my experience, but I'm willing to acknowledge I got to know... I first met Joe in 88, but didn't really get to know him until 91 onwards. So that time he was, what, you know, in his 70s. So I got the older Joe, you know. It was maybe more mellow. He wasn't the young kid scrambling to get to the top of the pile and, you know, having to overcome, you know, bankruptcies and distributors going. He made it, you know, so maybe he was more mellow as age brings. But he had a great sense of humour, and he used to make you laugh. I remember one year, I think it was maybe 2000, his anniversary was coming up with Betty. And he told me that Betty had this idea that they would celebrate the anniversary. They got places all over the place. They'd go stay in San Francisco for 3 or 4 days, Las Vegas for 3 or 4 days, New York for 3 or 4, and somewhere else. And Joe said to her, put me down for San Francisco. And that's the way he was. And he was always accessible to people. What I was trying to say before was, you know, they tend to look at me as Joe's boy, and they thought it was, you know, I'd wheedled my way into his good favour, but it was just the chance, you know. Even when he sold the company, he still used to come into the office just about every day, and he didn't have any executive position.
Right, he just couldn't stop coming in.
He called me up and say, I'm going to spare a few minutes. I think Joe Weider's asking me if I can spare a few minutes. Good God. I used to go up there, and it was just a reason for him to start talking about bodybuilding. He talked about all sorts of things. Joe was very educated, not at school, because he left early.
Yeah.
Very well read in all aspects of history and everything. Mm-hmm. And he would talk to you about, you know, what was going on in Iraq at the time or whatever, or he told me a story about, you know, how wolves decide who's the leader of the pack and all sorts. You know all this stuff. And then, what's Jay Cutler looking like? And, you know, he just wanted to talk. And his office was made up like a boardroom. There was a big desk as you walked in.
Mm-hmm.
It was oblong. But there wasn't many chairs around it. There were two main chairs right in the middle of the table next to each other. You would sit in one chair, Joe would sit next to you in the other chair, and they swiveled round and you faced each other and spoke. You were almost touching knees. There was none of this, I'm the boss, I'm on an elevated desk and you're sitting in front of me on a low stool. You were always legal. And I only sort of remembered this or came to mind after he died. It was just about always one-on-one with people. He never called big meetings. Very rarely did he say, I want to speak to all the editors or all the art directors. It was usually one-on-one, you know. And, you know, that was great. You know, I used to sit there thinking, here I am, you know, talking to Joe Weider. You know, back in the 60s, 70s, you know, these Arnold and those were gods, but Joe was Zeus. You know, he was the god of gods.
Yeah, he was the master blaster.
And to think that, you know, we used to go to Lake Tahoe, his other home, you know, for Labor Day or Thanksgiving or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he became like a second father to me. And I must say the same of Ben. You know, he always was a great supporter of mine because, I'll tell it straight, you know, I got to be where I was. You know, by the time Joe had stepped out, I was the guy who directed what those three magazines were all about.
Right.
And you had to be pretty resilient in a publishing house to get to that position. You had to take the knocks. You know, I was not treated well when I first went there because they thought this wild man was coming in to take over the magazines and take their job. Well, in the end, I did, but that was their fault, not my fault. But Ben was a great supporter. And I said about both of them, they're like second fathers. But then you realize, in the passing of time, they were second fathers to thousands, millions of people. You know, people would say, it was like a second father to me. Well, you thought you were special. Well, you were just one of a countless number of people who looked upon the brothers that way. They were very down to earth. You know, it was Joe was in Canada. He went to a British school, so we had similar senses of humour. He knew the British vernacular. My voicemail message, as you might know, because I think you've rung it, John. I end it by saying "Rule Britannia," you know, which is a song we sing in England.
Right.
And one night, Joe called. I wasn't in at home. I said the "Rule Britannia." Next thing I heard was "Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the world. Britain never, never, never shall be slave." You know, he knew the song.
He knew the song. That's hilarious.
I've still got the recording. I'll have to play it one time. Yeah.
That's funny what you said about when he met you in the office, because I remember watching Raw Iron, the Pumping Iron outtakes that they never really showed in the movie. And there was one scene where Arnold was talking with Joe in his office. And you're right, they were sitting behind the desk, facing each other with their chairs, talking to each other right next to each other.
Yeah. And Joe was, you know, he never had a big fancy car. He had a Lexus saloon. But not a Rolls Royce with a chauffeur. His house is a very, very nice house, but it's not a compound. It's not a mansion. It's probably got five bedrooms. It's got a guest house. But you can walk up the path and knock on the door. You know, it's not in a gated community or anything. Yeah, they were both very, very accessible. You know, and they would. One of the worst things about Joe was his day would start 8 or 9 o'clock at home. He would be reading all sorts of mail that came to him, new magazines, not just bodybuilder magazines, doing research. Then he would come in about lunchtime, but on the way in, he'd be driving in and he'd call you. Now, Joe wasn't the most attentive driver in the world, let's say that, you know. when he used to invite me out to lunch, he'd open the door. I said, "Oh, it's all the same to you, Joe. I'll sit in the trunk with my crash hat on." You know, that's how. But he'd call in, and you realizing that he wasn't always paying attention, and if you were talking to him, you were maybe making that worse to the road. I mean,
right?
And you'd explain something to him as easily as you could, and then the worst sound in the world you could hear was, "What?" And you had to tell him again. mm-hmm. you know. And then, you know, God damn, I know all three with him, you know. And he'd be all over the place. I saw him nearly knock somebody down, you know. But then later, you know, he did need a driver, but he still kept the Lexus. And his number plate was B-O-D-O-B-O-Y. What does that mean? He says, that's what Betty's always saying to me. You've got a lot to do, boy. D-O-D-O-B-O-Y. I don't wax enthusiastic about Joe in a phony way. That's the Joe I knew.
Right.
You know? And there it is. And yeah, he could be mean at times. You would go in with an idea and he'd rip it apart.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned to sort of, okay, Joe, we'll work on it. I'll come back tomorrow. I come back almost with the same thing. It was in a better mood. It was okay. I knew his moods. Keep away.
Yeah.
Today's
yeah.
not the day
Good. To
approach him. And some days he'd arrange to meet an athlete. And I knew it was a bad day. And I'd work it out that we'd remake the appointment for another day because I knew this athlete's not, whoever he is, he could be the next Arnold. He's not going to get a contract today.
Right.
And, you know, with Joe, he never, if you had an idea, he never ever said, how much is that going to cost?
Hmm.
How much are we going to make on this? What's the return on investment? He never spoke like that. It was mm-hmm. a good idea. It was a good idea. And that was the end of it. It was a bad yeah. idea. It was a bad idea. Cost didn't come into it. Not to say we were reckless, because I used to treat flex and muscle and fitness like I treated pumping press. You know, every penny counts. Don't waste mm-hmm. me.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you've got the right idea there. But, yeah, the memories of Joe are, you know, fantastic to think I had that time. And
It's memorable, too, what you said about how you could walk up to his house, because I remember reading his book. I'm rereading the book right now about Joe and Ben Weider, the one that the movie's based on. And he talks about when he was growing up, I think it was in Canada, probably the 1930s, maybe.
Yeah.
And he said how the whole neighborhood worked together. You know, like if somebody would bring you food over or if somebody needed something, neighbors would come over and help. And he said, you would never see that now. You know, like if I mentioned to one of my neighbors, hey, we cooked too much food for dinner. You want some? You know, they look at you like you're nuts, you know. But that's the background he grew up with. And you could tell from the way he wrote it, he was really, you know, he really looked back at those memories with fondness.
Yeah, he had great memories of those times, and he'd tell you about it. And, he loved, well, him and Ben, you know, the father was a saint. You know, his mother was, you know, pretty hard on them, but
yeah, pretty tough.
That was the way you were brought up in those days. You know?
Mm-hmm. All right, Peter. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I know, you know, you've been feeling bad sometimes, so I'm glad you got some chance to talk to us, and it's always great to talk to you. I'm going to take you up on your offer and come out to your house one day yes. soon, so Definitely. I can check out some of your pumping yes. press magazines.
Yeah, I've got a storeroom here where I've got the past 25 years of Flex and other magazines.
Wow, really?
collected over here. Uh-huh. And then back in England, we have a house there still. And in the attic there, I've got the previous 20 years. I never throw a magazine away. I love magazines. I realize the time for them will never be what it was. And it'll probably, you know, everybody's going to end up digital. But
Right.
I actually feel that in the modern day, everybody thinks because they follow a play-by-play almost in real life or a webcast and see the interviews after, you know, they know everything about the con. That's it. I don't need to read anymore.
Right.
But they don't. They don't see it. We used to go to an Olympia, three or four writers, do a 40-page report, you know, a main report, sidebars, who did that. Mm-hmm. Bring the atmosphere. That's what's yeah. missing. The side yeah. issues, the side stories, the subplots. Because by Wednesday after a contest, nobody's in. Oh, I know all about the contest. Phil Heath won, and that's the end of it. No, it's not the end of it. You have to know these things. It was, and because that was the first time you saw anything from the contest photographs, in those 40 pages, you'd get the whole Olympia in one stop, bang, every aspect mm-hmm. of it was there. And I miss those days. You know, you used to take your notes in the press pit. There was no laptops for you to do things, or you couldn't email stuff back. You had to get back to the office. I used to go back on the Sunday, transcribe all my tapes, probably work through Sunday night, most of Monday night, go in Tuesday morning and deliver the copy. And the other thing there is today, you can do a report, and just to check, you can look at the photographs. Those days you couldn't. You had to rely on your memory, because I had to hand in the report to start the process. The photographs, not digital, wasn't exist in those days.
Right.
Right until the Wednesday. So whatever I said about Mike Christian was based on what I saw on stage, not rechecking photographs to make sure that I'd got it right. For any writer, they were in the same position. So it's completely different. But I do thank you for this opportunity, John. And if there's any other aspect you ever want to talk about, you know, you're always welcome. You're a good friend. You're a loyal friend. And I appreciate your friendship over the years.
Yeah, I agree. I feel the same way, Peter, and I would love to have you back on the show, because I'm sure you got a million different stories, and your wealth of knowledge and what you said about the contest is right on the money. You know, I think by Monday, people are forgetting about it. Once they get the results, they've forgotten about it. And, you know, I agree with you. I grew up with the magazines, and it was that's where I got all my information. And you felt like you really knew what happened at the contest. You felt like you really knew these guys. I remember reading 8-page articles about a body roller. You know, and you found out where they live, where they grew up, you know, who they trained with, what their thoughts were. I remember reading an article when Ed Corney was training with Arnold for that 75 Olympia. And he just talked so much about Arnold's mental attitude and how it changed his mental attitude. And you'd never know that now today, you know, in the digital age. We miss all that.
Yeah, Arnold in many ways. I mean, he was more laid back and outgoing, but he was... You know, he had the same sort of dedication as Dorian. You know, everything counted. And again, I mean, I ended up with a great relationship with Arnold. He still sends a Christmas present every year.
Oh yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's awesome.
And you know, somebody once asked me, "Who are the real arseholes in bodybuilding?" And I said, "You know, the non-arseholes outnumber the arseholes by a huge amount, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's true, you know, that most of the guys are good. They have bad times, but essentially, you know, it's been a great ride to mix with all these people. You know, Lee Haney, I'm not dropping these names in, I don't mean to sound like that, but it's just, I've been very lucky that things just... I've just been lucky, you know. I people said I had a certain talent of writing. Well, maybe I do, but what got me to where I am is applying myself. I can say this as a 68-year-old old fart now. nobody worked harder than me when I was in that building.
Mm-hmm.
They maybe thought they did, but it's hard work that gets you there. All the genetics in the world, even for a bodybuilder, all the best genetics won't get you there unless you apply a resolute work ethic and work at it. That's the only way. Potential is only potential. You have to realize that potential. You have to work hard. It doesn't come naturally.
Right. Absolutely. I agree with you. All right, Peter. Well, thank you again for joining us on the podcast. I've been waiting for weeks to talk to you, and it's really been a great experience. I couldn't wait to get you on here to talk about the 1990 Olympia, but also about your career and about your thoughts about the bodybuilding scene and some of the good old days. So thanks again. And I'm glad you're feeling better. And I'm looking forward to seeing you and your lovely wife, Anne, again soon.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John. Like I say, I appreciate this. And you got me talking and saying things that maybe I'd forgotten about. So well done.
Yeah. Great. That's the best compliment.
Okay.
All right, Peter. I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you again.
Bye.
Take care. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. This wraps up season number 4. where we talked about the 1990 Mr. Olympia. I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine, Redcon One, and Old School Labs for sponsoring this season of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And join us next week. We will be starting season number 5, where we'll be talking about the historical NABBA Mr. Universe contest that takes place every year in London, and it started in 1950. So that's going to be a great series of interviews. Join us next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Have a happy new year, everybody, and we'll see you guys next week.